Today on Off Mic, Indiana's governor got a bird's eye view of Northwest Indiana's embattled lakeshore earlier this week. Could a disaster declaration be coming soon? We'll hear from Indiana State Senator Karen Tallien and Beverly Shores Town Council President Jeff Benson to get their take. And speaking about embattled, Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill isn't saying much about a proposal to suspend his license for 60 days. What does it all mean? Does it mean he would have to leave office? We'll talk to an expert on that. And is there anything that can be done about the struggling Chicago Bulls? All this and more on Off Mic. First, the news. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente. Well, since it's winter, most folks aren't venturing to the beach these days. But in some places in Northwest Indiana, there's really no more beach or very little of the sand. Erosion has snatched up all of the sand in some places. And now roads and homes are also being threatened in places like Porter, Long Beach, and Beverly Shores. But there's been a little bit of good news lately. After months of trying to get the state of Indiana to take the issue seriously, Governor Eric Holcomb issued an executive order this week saying the state will survey the damage and try to see if a disaster declaration is indeed an option. Holcomb boarded an Indiana State Police helicopter last Sunday to get a firsthand assessment of the situation. Jeff Benson doesn't need a bird's eye view to do that. He's got a front row seat. Jeff is the president of the Beverly Shores Town Council, and he joins us by phone to discuss this latest development. Welcome to Off Mic, Jeff.
Hello. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Well, Jeff, before we get into this, tell me, you know, I was out there maybe about a month ago. You gave me a great tour of the area and see what's happening. What is the latest right now as it stands with erosion? How's it affecting Beverly Shores?
So we're in between storms, and let me say that, first of all, thank you for all your help bringing magnifying glasses to this problem and getting more awareness downstate and around here. This ties back to November, and if everybody thinks back to Thanksgiving, we had about 5 days of storms, north winds with high waves. And that's what really kind of did us in and broke the seawall. And then each storm in between, there was one, the next one, we had one in December, but not too bad. And then the first Saturday of January, now we just had one a week ago, Thursday, that was not as bad as we thought, which was good. And now we have one coming up, I think, next Wednesday. And we're able to look at wind direction because our lake is 300 miles long. So the damage in November really kind of opened up some sores to the lake and where the revetment wasn't, where the rocks from the 80s and 70s that had been put there. We have been trying to hold back the lake where we can and repair the damage caused by the November storm. Each storm causes a little bit more damage in these other pockets of scour on the beach. And we are right now trying to do what the governor asked us to do, which is get numbers for that damage and assess each one. We've been working with the National Park with the trap bags, and they've done that twice, and they've survived two big storms with two different sets of trap bags. But it seems to be working. And then with our project, where we've spent all our money from our GO bond on the big revetment repair at Hutchinson. We now have three other places that we are looking at trying to repair. We have a very bad scour at 311 Lakefront.
Jeff, can you kind of describe what is a scour?
So a scour, what we're calling them, is where the waves come over the revetment and start eroding at the sand dune. And so the wave hits the bottom of the sand dune, and then the top of the sand dune falls in. If you've ever been to Central Avenue Beach or Mount Baldy in the last 10 or 15 years, those are giant scours where the lake is chewing away at the bottom of the sand dune, and the sand dune gets so steep, the cliff gets so steep that the top falls in. And so we have, they look like scallops on a scallop. So it's a sort of a semicircle of sand erosion, and that's what we're calling our scours.
Jeff, let me ask you this. We've been talking to also U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and they've been predicting that the lake levels in Lake Michigan were going to reach record highs right around this time. Are you noticing an increase in the lake levels? And is a lot of the problems with erosion having to do with those rising lake levels?
Yes, we're getting hit with three things simultaneously. One is the temperatures. The air temperatures aren't as cold as they have been, so we're not getting the shelf ice. And the evaporation is not occurring as fast as it should be, and the lake level. So, like last year, we had the polar vortex, and so we could have a big storm, but it was pounding the ice, not the shoreline. This year, we just started last Saturday, starting to form a little bit of shelf ice, which is protecting our shoreline right this second. But you know, this weekend when it warms up, that might go away. Yes, we're noticing that the increased lake levels. I heard an incredible statistic from the Michigan National Weather Service that 2013 was the all-time low of the lake. And if you were standing, if you were 5.5 feet tall, standing on the edge of the water in 2013, today it would be over your head. It's gone up 5.5 feet vertically since 2013.
That is striking. Let me ask you this then. So you've been sort of pounding your head against the wall, so to speak, and probably literally, and not only monitoring the lake, monitoring the weather reports, and doing your own almost volunteer repair, patching up of the revetment in your town. A lot of it because the state of Indiana just hasn't been as responsive. What do you take of Governor Holcomb's latest tour of the area by helicopter and his executive order?
So it's an improvement. It isn't as far as we need to go, but it's opened the door to more conversations, and that's good. We were hoping he didn't offer me the helicopter ride. I would have loved to have been his tour guide to help point things out, but we're hoping that he comes for a ground tour so he can see it up close and personal, because the pictures that he took that supplied with the press release were, it was great. It's proof that he was here in the helicopter, but there's also some, you know, a little bit of shelf ice protecting the edge. And I hope that he was at a low enough altitude that he could really see the magnitude of this.
Right. The photos that attached the press release that the press got, I believe just yesterday, show two photos, an aerial photo of the lakeshore, and you see some homes there. I'm not exactly sure where it was taken. It could have been Portage, but it really doesn't show the magnitude of what's going on, especially how it's threatening and the damage near the Portage Lakefront Pavilion.
Right. The two pictures that were included were, one was Long Beach and the other was right by Lakeview. And it took a while to identify it, but that's what it was. You could see the orange barricades that are barricading the parking lot at Lakeview, the National Park area, and the bathrooms at Broadway and Lakefront Drive and Beverly Shores.
So Jeff, but the thing is with the emergency, he had this declaration. It's not an emergency declaration. It's going to be more fact-finding, more getting information. And yes, it's dialogue, and he got up here to take a look at that. But it's still short of what you need to do, and it seems like time is of the essence.
It really is. If we had 700,000 right now, we would be deploying the contractors to repair the revetment where these scours are to get up front of this storm that's coming Wednesday. And when I say a storm, what I mean is they're predicting 35-mile-an-hour winds out of the north. And that, to us, with this high lake level, is a storm. So that's what we do. We have two very serious scours right now. They're in the old locations where there used to be houses on the north side of Lakefront Drive. There's the old foundation and the old seawalls that have collapsed. And so there is nothing between them and 300 miles of Lake Michigan. And so that's what is getting our attention right now. And that's what we're holding a fundraiser for. The town has, you know, is looking at borrowing more money or going deeper into debt, because that's what we've spent, is our, the money that we've borrowed. But in the meantime, we don't have that money, nor can we spend it if we don't have it. And so we're taking donations to try to fix, to get enough to fix these two scours, which is kind of crazy, but that's where we're at.
So are you telling me a town in Indiana is setting up a sort of GoFundMe page to do some repair work?
Essentially, yep. We're trying to avoid the fees that they take from GoFundMe and use direct checks to the town. Yes, that's what we're doing, and we're that's what we're doing.
So is a fundraiser, is there like an event attached to it, or is it just strictly, hey, we need your money, send in a check?
So this is, there is not an event. This is it's a bake sale where you get a virtual cookie. So we're asking people to send money if they, you know, want to drive along the lake this summer. That would be great to help us out. I'd say that the edge of the scour right now is probably, it's 20 feet high and maybe 20 feet from the road. And so if it gets chewed at the bottom next Wednesday, that it's very likely we could, you know, have to close that road right there. So, yeah, they can send checks to Town of Beverly Shores. That's 500 South Broadway, 46301. And it would be, any help is appreciated. And we're really doing that because the bond council and trying to do all that, there's wheels that are turning, but they're not turning fast enough. And so we're trying all fronts. We're trying the emergency declaration. We're trying to inventory it, get estimates for repairing these things, assess the damage, monetize the damage, get that to the governor for him to declare an emergency, which then will open up the pipeline to potential federal money or reimbursement. But in the meantime, we're scrambling to actually do work.
Now, Jeff, one of the things we haven't talked about, and I just want to mention real quick, you know, you've got these five homes in Beverly Shores that are historic homes that were built, or they're historic homes from almost the turn of the century, about 100 years ago in Chicago, the Century of Progress World's Fair in Chicago, that were then barged over to Beverly Shores soon after that in the 30s. They're at risk of damage from this erosion, including that beautiful pink flamingo house right on the beach. Can you tell us a little bit more how, you know, what's the situation like for those homes?
So I know that they're having conversations. So it's a little complicated in that the National Park owns the homes, and then they're leased to the Indiana Landmarks, and then Indiana Landmarks leases them to people that have restored them and opened them for the Century of Progress home tours. But the individual people have remodeled them and paid for that. And there are discussions going on between the National Park and the Indiana Landmarks and the owners as to what is possible and what they can do. But the cliffs of sand in front of them is getting awfully close to the houses.
Jeff, so we've seen the governor's press release and the executive order to start doing this work. But have you gotten something specifically from anybody from the state of Indiana to say, okay, what information? Because I'm thinking you probably already have the information he's needing. You know, what's the timetable like in terms of what do you need to get to the state, and when do you need a decision by whether the state's going to help out or not?
Wow. a month ago, that's, I think, my answer. What he is asking his agencies to do is to reach out to us, or, you know, assemble the damage information. So we're coming at it. We have been coming at it from a different way. We've been coming at it as to how much is it going to cost to fix it. And I guess in a mirror image, that is the cost of the damage. So we are trying to get three bids from, contractors for the remaining. We know what it has cost us to date with that Hutchinson scour that we did over Christmas and New Year's, and that was $300,000, and our efforts with the Lakeview, with the National Park. But, that we don't have numbers on their manpower and equipment that they've put towards it. And I'm not sure that would qualify, but it would be helpful to show what kind of damage that is. And that's so I think the numbers from Long Beach and Portage Lakefront will also help. The other thing that I don't know is what is the exact number that we hit when he will throw the switch for the emergency declaration. Is it $37 million like Chicago, or is it, $5 million or $1 million, or, I don't know what the number is that says, yep, it's an emergency. Also seems crazy that you kind of need those numbers to decide to make an emergency instead of saying, yep, I see that. That's an emergency. Your road's going to fall in.
Yeah, I could see that, and I'm not a rocket scientist. Well, Jeff, we'll be monitoring this as it goes along. Well, Jeff Benson is the president of the Beverly Shores Town Council. Jeff, thank you for being here with On Off Mic.
Thank you so much, Michael, and thanks for continuing to spread the word about this.
A state attorney general ought to have a law license, right? Indiana state law says so, and a disciplinary hearing officer has recommended that Curtis Hill's license be suspended for 60 days over allegations of sexual misconduct. So what would that mean? I'm Matt Pelser. Next time on All In, we'll catch up with our State House reporter who's been covering the Curtis Hill saga, and we'll hear what the General Assembly's been up to as well. Plus, an update on Pete Buttigieg's campaign. Join us.
Tune in weekdays at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Stop in this Friday and visit with the Pita Stop on this week's edition of Let's Eat. We're traveling to the South Lake Mall to nibble on some Grecian delights. Meet us at the Tavana as we sit down with chef, owner, and operator Anna and her son Paul. We'll be discussing the Mediterranean street food scene. Call in 769-9577 and join the discussion with the Pita Stop from the South Lake Mall and win a gift card. We're traveling to Greek islands. We're sitting down, ripping a little pita, tasting a little baklava, and sipping some ouzo with Anna and Paul from the Pita Stop this Friday at 3 o'clock on Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick. Tune in to 89.1 FM WLPR, Lakeshore Public Radio. Call in and join the fun. Opa!
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, we've been talking about the issue about erosion. The state of Indiana's governor, Eric Holcomb, recently toured the area and issued an executive order to possibly declare a disaster for the area, but it's not a done deal. And joining us now to talk about the issue and this latest development is Indiana State Senator Karen Tallien. Hello, Senator.
Good morning.
And thank you for being patient with us. We were trying to get to you as soon as possible.
No problem.
Well, I know you've been on this issue of erosion in Northwest Indiana for a while. Everybody else has been kind of pins and needles on this. Of course, our state has been kind of slow to react. What's your take on this executive order by the governor?
Well, I'm glad that we finally got his attention, that there's a serious issue up here. I don't know if you know this, but I put together a letter to the governor some time ago. We hand-delivered it the very first week of January. It was the first day of session. And it basically pleaded with the governor to see that we had a problem up here. I attached all of the declarations of emergencies that had been done by all of the small towns up here, and, well, Ogden Dunes, Portage, Long Beach, Beverly Shores, and I think Dune Acres, and the Porter County, and Porter County. So I attached all this stuff, and when you see in his executive order, he's referring to a letter of January 15th. Well, the letter of January 15th was sent to me, basically saying, look, we don't see any infrastructure damage. Sorry, we can't help you right now. So the fact that they're now recognizing that there's a problem is a huge first step.
But let me ask you this. It's a huge first step, but we're kind of in the, I guess, getting into the late innings of a ball game that needs attention right now. Is it almost coming a little bit too late?
Well, I certainly hope not. As I was waiting for you, I just drove up to the viewing area at the Portage Pavilion, and I see that out on the lake now, there's beginning to form ice. Hopefully, that ice will stay there for a while, and protect what we have from the next storm. I was listening while you were talking to Jeff Benson.
Well, Senator, let me ask you this, and I've asked this to other elected officials about this issue. Why has it been so difficult? I, of course, cover Chicago during the week and parts of Chicago, and we see the erosion situation there, and they're tackling it. In fact, the state of Illinois actually declared an emergency to tackle the issue in Chicago. Why has it been so difficult on this side of the state line to get the state of Indiana to pay attention?
I don't know the answer to that. As you know, I have been working on this for a while. We have been, and for a while, I mean a couple of years. We have been dealing with the Army Corps of Engineers. We have been trying to get permits. We have been trying to, well, the first thing that I managed to get through was the bill that talked about any sand that was dredged out of the lake needs to be replaced back onto a beach instead of taken out, and dumped into the middle of the lake. So we've been working on this for a while, but I heard Jeff say this, and I want to reiterate this. There are a number of causes to this problem. There is a longstanding 20-year problem.
Well, welcome to Northwest Indiana with the trains. We know where you're
at. Right. Yeah, that's right. So there is a longstanding problem with the construction at the Port of Indiana. This goes back to the late 60s when the port was first constructed, and what was predicted then has come true, and that the whatever is downdrift, in this case west of the port, is not getting the natural amount of sand that would normally flow around the lake. So that's been a problem. We've been working on that. Heck, I worked on that. There was a lawsuit when I was in law school, and that was 30 years ago, I worked on that lawsuit then. So that's one big problem. Right now we have another critical problem, and that's the winter storms and the lack of an ice shelf or, an ice barricade that would protect the shoreline from those severe storms.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a number of things going on right now that has brought this to a critical level.
I'm sure you're hoping, though, that the governor, even though this is a positive step that's happening, that, you know, his decision to issue an emergency declaration, if he decides to do that, isn't prolonged, that it doesn't take too long. Are you going to be nudging the governor's office to, like, hey, what's going on with that, with this assessment?
Well, right. So I do know, because I did receive this information from Congressman Visklosky's office a while ago. There are procedures that have to be in place before you actually can apply from FEMA for money. FEMA's got billions of dollars for aid for things like disasters. But you have to go through a process. And one of the processes is that you do have to do an assessment of what the damage is. Now, one of the things that is kind of strange to me is that they want you to tell them how much money or how much damage you have, but they don't seem to have a category for preventative maintenance. So in other words, that we don't want to wait until the Shore Drive at Beverly Shores has been undermined and fallen into the lake before we apply for help. We're trying to make sure that that doesn't happen. So I'm not sure. We're still a little confused about how FEMA takes care of preventative, you know, measures, but we're working on it.
All right. Well, Senator, I do have to ask you another question that's off topic. It's actually a part of our next segment where we're going to be talking about the future of Indiana's Attorney General Curtis Hill. Now, you're running for Attorney General on the Democratic ticket. We do know that just earlier this week there was a recommendation that Curtis Hill serve a 60-day his license be suspended for 60 days. Without an automatic reinstatement. Some people say that could take a long time, that it could end up with him having to step, you know, to resign from office. He hasn't said anything what he's going to do or not do. And do you have a comment on how he should handle this?
Well, so I'll try not to have this. I'll try to have this be factual as opposed to a political campaign ad, Michael. But
okay.
So here's what's going on. The disciplinary proceeding has two parts. First of all, there was the hearing where former Chief Justice Myra Selby presided as the hearing officer. Then she just issued her opinion. Her opinion is a report that says, you know, the results of the hearing, plus a recommendation. Now, that recommendation then goes to the Indiana Supreme Court. And there is a briefing schedule. There's 30 days, 30 days, and then 15 more days. So we expect that it won't actually arrive at the Supreme Court in their lap until about May 1st. Then, of course, there's no deadline for them. They're the Supreme Court. They'll answer when they get around to it. We hope that it's soon, because in June, both the Democrats and the Republicans will hold their state convention where the nominee will be chosen. So let me explain a little bit about the license suspension with and without automatic reinstatement.
Well, actually, the next segment kind of deals with that.
You're going to do that.
But just in your opinion, quickly, do you think he should resign or not?
I think that for the good of all, he should resign. It's not my place to call for him to resign, but, you know, this is like, I was there during Watergate. You know, there was a time that even Richard Nixon said, for the good of the country, we need to shut this down. And he resigned. And I think Curtis Hill, you know, it's clear what he did. The only question is, what should be his punishment? And, you know, I just think that in the position that he is, where he's supposed to be the top law enforcement officer in the state, he should lead by example. And he obviously hasn't done that. So
okay.
I think he's going to be suspended. He should do the right thing and step down.
Well, Karen Tallon is an Indiana State Senator. Thank you, Karen Tallon, for joining us here on Off Mic.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. And coming up, we'll talk more about the future for Indiana's embattled Attorney General Curtis Hill.
Next weekend is the biggest comic book convention in the Midwest. Chicago Comic Con and Entertainment Expo, or C2E2, is a huge gathering of nerds from all walks of life, guests from the industry, and some childhood heroes, all to celebrate the passions we live every day. Tom Rosie from the 501st Star Wars Cosplay Group joins us to give you the lowdown on C2E2 on the next Region Nerd Alert, every Saturday at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
A state attorney general ought to have a law license, right? Indiana state law says so, and a disciplinary hearing officer has recommended that Curtis Hill's license be suspended for 60 days over allegations of sexual misconduct. So what would that mean? I'm Matt Pelser. Next time on All In, we'll catch up with our State House reporter who's been covering the Curtis Hill saga, and we'll hear what the General Assembly's been up to as well, plus an update on Pete Buttigieg's campaign. Join us.
Tune in weekdays at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Earlier this week, a hearing officer for the Indiana Supreme Court recommended Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill's license be suspended for 60 days without an automatic reinstatement. The proposed punishment is for Hill's behavior at a party at an Indianapolis bar in March 2018 to celebrate the end of the legislative session. Four women, three legislative staffers, and a state representative from Northwest Indiana accused Hill of touching them and making inappropriate comments at the bar. A special prosecutor declined to press charges against Hill, who maintains his innocence. But the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission filed charges against Hill. A hearing took place last fall where the women and Hill testified. The end result is the hearing officer, Myra Selby, said Hill committed battery to the women and used his elected office to try to retaliate against the women. The Indiana Supreme Court has not yet made a decision whether to accept Selby's conclusion, and Hill has not made a comment about it either. Selby recommended a 60-day suspension without automatic reinstatement, but what does that mean exactly? I asked a former chairman of the Indiana Supreme Court's Disciplinary Commission, Tony Walker, an attorney from Gary, that very question. Mr. Walker, when an attorney in Indiana is suspended without an automatic reinstatement, what does that entail?
Well, and I think as it relates to this specific case, I think we have to just be cautious that there hasn't been any discipline imposed yet. Only the Indiana Supreme Court can do that. But in a general sense, if the Supreme Court does suspend an attorney without an automatic reinstatement, then after the suspension period terminates, that attorney would have to petition to the court to be reinstated. And then those petitions are signed to the Indiana Disciplinary Commission, and a hearing officer is appointed by the Supreme Court to hear the petition, and it's up to the attorney to prove that, number one, whatever condition existed that he violated previously, that was the subject of the suspension, has been remedied, that they're remorseful, and that they can be recommended to the public for their services once again.
During your suspension, are you able to perform any kind of legal work?
No. Once the when a suspension is issued by the Supreme Court, in the court's opinion, they have the effective date of the suspension. It can be a week or 2 weeks. Sometimes in more extraordinary cases, it can maybe be 3 or 4 weeks, at which date you are no longer permitted to practice law at all. And in the interim period between receiving your the opinion of your discipline and having it be effective, you're to notify all of your clients that you, in fact, are not eligible to continue representing them. And there has to be a written notice of this to all the clients that that person represents at that time.
Reinstatement, however, can be a lengthy process. How long does it take?
Well, the burden is totally on the petitioner to not only show that they meet the criteria to be reinstated, but also to move the process along. Because typically the Supreme Court appoints trial judges or other attorneys. I myself have served 4 times as a reinstatement hearing officer, and I have a case now for a reinstatement. So most of the appointees, this is something that the Supreme Court is pointing them to do in addition to what they typically do for their job if they're a trial judge or an attorney. So there's no sort of set docket or clerk that's moving that case along. So typically the petitioner or the petitioner's counsel has to sort of keep the case moving. And the Indiana Disciplinary Commission at that point sort of serves as the opposing party to the petition, that being sort of the investigative body that had initially investigated the charges against that attorney. So they sort of have to, under our statute and Supreme Court rules, argue why that person should not be reinstated. So it's an adversarial process. So that means there's discovery that takes place, as with a regular trial, and that can be rather lengthy given how many charges were previously against the attorney that was suspended. So typically from the point, and there are also obligations that he has to make in terms of passing certain tests for professional responsibility and ethics. So by the time, from the time you, and a petitioner would maybe file the petition with the court for reinstatement until actually having a ruling on that, probably averages somewhere between 12 and 18 months.
Does an attorney need to be convicted or charged with a crime to be suspended?
No, it's a much higher standard, you know, among the Supreme Court in terms of your conduct. So it doesn't have to rise to the level of being criminal. Although if you do something criminal, then it's pretty much automatically going to be a suspension with the Supreme Court. But no, you just have to have violated the code of ethics as laid out by the Indiana Supreme Court, which is a pretty high standard.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Walker. Is there a timetable for the Indiana Supreme Court to act on the recommendation?
Yeah, so what happens in a disciplinary case, the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission sort of serves as a grand jury. So the attorneys that work for that body would bring facts before the commission, and the commission to sort of vote yay or nay as to whether or not violations should be charged against a particular attorney. So once the commission votes yes, then a hearing officer is appointed to basically have a trial of those violations. Oftentimes they sort of end in some type of agreement between the parties and don't go to a full hearing. This particular case did go to a full hearing before a hearing officer that was formerly a Indiana Supreme Court justice. So, as I said, that the trial of the matter can also take an extended period of time for reasons I previously stated. These are hearing officers that are appointed that have other jobs and whatnot. So once the trial is concluded, then there's usually a period where both sides are given an opportunity to file proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, sort of their summary of why they should win. And then once that's filed, the hearing officer will consider the testimony that was presented in the hearing, as well as review the proposed findings and conclusions of both sides and issue an opinion with a recommendation. So that those findings of fact and conclusions of law, which are ultimately issued by the hearing officer, are then filed with the Indiana Supreme Court. The Indiana Supreme Court will review the findings of the hearing officer, and eventually they will have a meeting among themselves and come to a decision as to what discipline to actually issue. The recommendation of the hearing officer is just a recommendation. The court can stick with that, or they can come up with something totally different.
Mr. Walker, how common is it for the Supreme Court to go against the recommendation of the hearing officer in a disciplinary case?
Yeah, I don't have hard numbers on it, Mike, but it's not uncommon. I mean, probably half the time the court, because, you know, the hearing officer is one person, and while they may, you know, they are the person appointed to hear the facts, once the facts are sort of recorded, what discipline should be imposed is really a matter of sort of personal standard among different justices. I served on the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission for 10 years, and over that 10 years, we had several different justices that saw things very differently on different types of offenses. So you have one justice that may be on there, particularly when I first went on 10, 11 years ago, that if you committed a crime, he thought you should be disbarred and never allowed back. Now, at one point, you have justices that were appointed to the court that, under the same set of facts, would say, no, it's not a disbarment case. He should be out for 5 years without an automatic, leaving open the possibility of the person coming back after 5 years. So a lot of the actual discipline comes down to personal opinion and legal philosophy of the individual justices. So you oftentimes have a different, and what happens is because you have five judges with a majority that have to agree, their compromise is made. So if you have the one justice that feels disbarment is the right way, you have another justice that feels a five-year sentence, but you still need one more. You still need one more to, or I should say, each of them need two more to agree with their position. So you probably end up having a lot of compromises in those judicial conferences as well. So not uncommon to come out with an end conclusion that is different from the recommendation.
Mr. Walker, what can you tell me about the hearing officer in the Curtis Hill case, Myra Selby? I believe she once served on the Indiana Supreme Court, correct?
Yes, she's a African-American attorney. She's in private practice now. She was once a member of the Indiana Supreme Court, appointed by Evan Bayh.
Is she highly respected?
Yes, very much so. And she was appointed to this position by Chief Justice Rush.
Mr. Walker, it's been described by others that this 60-day suspension without automatic reinstatement as a sort of kiss of death. Do you see it that way?
Well, I wouldn't call it a kiss of death. It really depends on what you've done. The onus is on you to prove that whatever the problem was has been rectified. So if it's not a disbarment, it does at least leave open the possibility of you coming back into practice. But it is not guaranteed, and it is not easy. And even though the suspension may only be for 60 days, if once you add on or tack on to that a non-automatic, it really means that it's going to take you between an additional year or to 2 years after your suspension to actually be active practicing again, if you're permitted to.
So even after you finish serving the 60 days, you can't just go back practicing law?
No, you have to. It's almost like applying to the bar again for the first time, but worse. There's no test involved, but the standard now is higher for you because you're no longer getting the benefit of the doubt. And anything that you've done previously can and will be held against you.
Tony Walker is an attorney from Gary and a former chairman of the Indiana Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission. Mr. Walker, thank you for being here on Off Mic.
All right, Mike. Good talking with you.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, now that the glitz and glamour of the NBA All-Star Game has come and gone to Chicago, the Chicago Bulls are back to playing and losing at the United Center. They lost their seventh straight game last night to Michael Jordan's Charlotte Hornets. There's been some rumors that perhaps a change is in the works at the top of the Bulls. Joining us to talk about the future of the Bulls and all things sports is veteran sports reporter Cheryl Ray-Stout. Hey, Cheryl.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And there's no one I'd rather talk about the Bulls with than you. Because you know.
I don't know if that's a good thing.
Well, let me add, there's been talk that perhaps the Chicago Bulls are looking to move Guy Forman or bring in somebody else. What have you been hearing about this?
Yeah, that is pretty much the standard talk that's going around the league right now. Especially coming off the All-Star events last weekend, apparently Michael Reinsdorf is looking to make some changes in the front office. We don't know who it's going to be, but expect to hear a lot of names be dropped in the next few weeks, and likely this will be announced once the season's over with. But there will be changes in the front office, and how that trickles down, we don't know just yet.
Cheryl, were you at last night's game?
Yes, I was.
What's the attendance situation at the United Center these days for the Bulls?
You're seeing a lot more empty seats throughout the different levels. You know, you had two of the worst teams in the league last night playing against each other. The only thing that actually helped the attendance was that it was a Boy Scout and Girl Scout night. Seriously. Otherwise, there are a lot of empty seats, and that's what Jerry and specifically Michael Reinsdorf knows that they have to address, because if you see empty seats, that's reflective of what's going on in the court. And that's an easy sign to them that they got to do something to make a change.
You know, it's funny that the Bulls are struggling, and their glory days, of course, are with Michael Jordan. But Michael Jordan's own Charlotte Hornets, they're not doing any better either. So you can't even look to him anymore to like for possible solutions.
No. Michael Jordan, he's an owner. I know that Michael does not do a lot hands-on with the team. In fact, Michael spends a lot of his time on a fishing boat in Florida, so he does not, or the golf course. No, he doesn't have a lot of imprint on the Charlotte Hornets. And so when people talk about, oh, maybe the Bulls should have him come back, no, Michael's not interested in the front office thing anymore. That's not his repertoire. But the thing is, that with the Bulls, you're talking about a franchise that has been at the mountaintop. You know, win six championships. And just a few years ago, they were in the Eastern Conference Finals. You know, an injury to, you know, Derrick Rose changed the whole course of that team. It's just been these last few years with this rebuild that just has not taken hold. And I want to make sure we credit Zach LaVine has played so well this year. He was great after the game last night. He talked about his situation. He says, look, for me, the glass is half full. I'm going to play like every game is important. He's not going to let off on the gas pedal. I've talked to the assistant coaches, and they're concerned for Zach because he deserves much better than what he has. And the fact is they have too many role players around him, and he needs a number two star. And everyone thought that would be Lauri Markkanen, but Lauri Markkanen has been injured. And also, for some reason, Jim Boylan just does not use him well offensively. So unless Lauri Markkanen can step up, or unless the Bulls can find a player equal to Zach LaVine, they're going to continue their struggles.
Well, I got to tell you, Cheryl, we're calling. You know, obviously, this is on Lakeshore Public Radio in Northwest Indiana, and we're in the state that also has the Indiana Pacers,
right.
And just like when the Bears were struggling, the Indianapolis Colts became very popular in Northwest Indiana and started stealing those fans away. Something similar can happen because I'm starting to see a lot more Pacer jerseys in Northwest Indiana. And, you know, as a Bulls fan, that's always heartbreaking to me. So Bulls got to, I think they got to worry about that a little bit.
Well, they actually, the team that the Bulls really have been getting a lot of the Bulls fans is the Milwaukee Bucks.
Oh, that's right. Right.
That's a team. Giannis is just what a terrific player all the way around. It's a fun team to watch. If you have an opportunity to watch them play, it's a very well put together playoff team, and hopefully they'll make a run at it because I really enjoy watching the way that team plays. But that's the team that the Bulls have to worry about, and Giannis will be a free agent in 2 years.
Wow. Well, maybe he'll like to travel a little south and play for the Bulls.
That would be nice.
Well, tomorrow, I believe the opening games to spring training starts out in Arizona for both the Cubs and Sox. Pretty exciting time.
It is. I mean, you know, a lot of people are kind of curious what's going to unfold for the White Sox with all this talent, with all the young players, with the veterans. We're going to see Ronaldo Lopez on the mound. He has to have a turnaround season. He had the second worst ERA in the league. There's going to be interesting competition at second base. Will they, you know, have Lourdes Garcia? Will it be Danny Mendrick? Will it be Nick Madrigal? That's going to be the fun competition to watch there. And also Tim Anderson and Yoan Moncada, they're going to flip between leadoff and batting second. So we'll see how they play. And watching, we got to look at the defensive improvement of Tim Anderson and Aloy Jimenez. So that's something to watch. And there's no doubt fans are going to love watching Luis Roberts hitting home runs. On the flip side with the Cubs, interesting what new manager David Ross is doing. He's going to have Chris Bryant, the guy that we've been hearing about so much this offseason about being traded, he's going to be their leadoff man. And wow, that's an interesting situation because you've been saying a lot about this player. He will be batting leadoff, and Anthony Rizzo will be batting second. So that's going to be interesting to watch that scenario. Don't say that the trade rumors are gone completely, but right now, Bryant's going to be a very important part of that team. What David Ross is also doing in these first few games, he's trying to find his fifth starter. He's going to go with Alec Mills on Saturday, Tyler Chetwood on Sunday, and Albert Elzele on Monday. So, you know, they're looking for a fifth starter. They're also trying to figure out what's going to happen at second base. They signed Jason Kipnis, the kid from Northbrook, Illinois, who played with the Cleveland Indians his whole career, to a minor league contract. He's going to be fighting it out with David Bodie and also the rookie from last year, Nico Horner. So there's some interesting stories to watch in these first few weeks of the season.
And, yeah, you know, it is interesting about Chris Bryant leading off. Maybe it's David Ross's way of saying, hey, look, you're still a central component to this team, and we want you here. And maybe it's a message to management to say you cannot get rid of this guy.
Well, I'm sure he wants to keep him. But understand that front office is going to have a lot to say what David Ross does as a manager. We've heard that they will have a lot to say about how he uses people. So I think the front office is very much in step with this. It also, if he's very good at it, if he performs well, it does sweeten the pot if they try to trade him, because it becomes even a bigger commodity for them if they decide to trade him. So there's a lot at stake. But for David Ross, since they have not had Dexter Fowler, they have not been able to fill that leadoff spot. I mean, last year we saw Jason Hayward do it. You know, we've seen Kyle Schwarber do it. Anthony Rizzo. So they have never been set at leadoff. And so if you start out at the gate, if you're successful at it, it will help for this team going forward. But it's interesting to take somebody with power numbers to put at that top spot.
Well, you can catch all of Cheryl Ray Stout's reporting during the week on WBEZ Radio in Chicago. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic today.
You're welcome, Michael.
Well, that's all we have for today's show. You can hear this program again on lakeshorepublicradio.org or on the NPR NAP. I'd like to thank my producers, Jose Rodriguez, El Hombre, and the fabulous D. Dotson, and El Wapo, Tommy Maloney. And thank you for listening to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio with me, Michael Puente. You can hear me the rest of the week again on WBEZ in Chicago. Have a great weekend.